Warm with a high of 75. Right now, a little breezy. Wind west at 14, gusting to 24. 66 degrees, Kenosha, 65 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave
Friday
McGrath,
morning show.
10 past 8.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, and both related to dogs. One newly recorded, the other from the morning show archives. Here's part one.
Okay.
We are spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about something near and dear to my heart, namely dogs. As the owner of two beautiful golden retrievers, I never tire of learning more about what's affectionately known as man's best friend. And we're going to be talking dogs today for the next few minutes with Jennifer S. Holland, which they are able to learn. This really interesting book is published by National Geographic. And Jennifer Holland, we welcome you to the morning show.
Love them. There's always been something very special there. And I think I started thinking a little beyond just kind of loving dogs, in more recent years, just observing them and noticing their incredible body language and their emotional intelligence and just the learning about olfaction and just how powerful that is in dogs and what that means for them in the way that they see the world. And that got me kind of digging in a little bit into the world of working dogs and what we can learn about how dogs think and how smart they really are. Mm.
You certainly talk with a wide range of really interesting dog trainers and dog experts and so on. And when you ask one of them in which dogs...
All the way back, because if you think about the beginnings of domestication, you know, dogs were making decisions to be tolerant of humans and adapting to stay with us. You know, they are everywhere we are. And they also live on the streets. The vast majority of dogs are not. It's still a valid life. It's still, you know, a dog existence for those animals. And so they're really remarkably adaptable to whatever situation is thrown at them.
In the chapter of the book called What Makes a Dog a Dog, you take a few minutes to sort of disavow us of the notion that dogs and wolves are closely tied together. You do clarify that dogs and wolves share a common ancestor, but you go on to say dogs have been their own kind of animal for a very long time. You know, maybe the dog's willingness to simply be near us. I mean, another way would be that, you know, that they tolerate humans, but, you know, to some extent even seem to crave connection with humans. And it's so interesting to think about where that might have come from.
Yeah. You know, when people talk about domestication, often there's a story that, you know, early humans took a wolf cub and probably raised it up, and that was sort of the beginning of the dog. And it's possible that something like that happened, but more likely, you know, the dogs were kind of the ones that initiated a lot of that. And I think a novel stimulus have to be before an animal will run from it and probably let you get pretty close before it decides to go. So you see it just in our everyday interactions with dogs, their tolerance of the way we are as we're primates, and primates and canines have different, some of these things are things I dug into.
Right. And I love this notion that at one point when you say compared with young wolves, dogs are more comfortable with novelty and less fearful. Mm-hmm. And it's just courage when it comes to daring to experience novelty, which is really, really fun to talk about. As someone who owns a couple of golden retrievers from hunting stock, I loved hearing some of what you said about hunting dogs and what they learn in terms of what they do. And you tell us that the task of the typical hunting dog is a lot harder than we might think. I mean, for instance, a dog that is out with a duck hunter, you know, running out into the field to retrieve the duck that's just been shot out of the sky. You write, the task is harder and more complex than it may seem. Explain the kind of the complication of this, or the complexity of this that we sometimes miss. And by understanding it, of course, we understand and appreciate the intelligence and skill of the dog all the more.
Yeah. You know, I think it's when you think about the natural, this is where instinct kind of comes in, the instinct of an animal. If they're going to be out, for example, with a duck hunter, you know, the instinct of the dog would be to attack that bird and to, you know, be mouthy with it and to, you know, not to go and gently bring it back to the human and let it, you know, give it over. Obviously retrievers are bred for that. And so, you know, part of that is in the genes, but they also have to be trained and to make that choice to do that correctly and, you know, to follow these commands and these rules. And I had never really thought about what that means for them to, you know, kind of take that away from them in a sense. And yet I think we replace it with other things that they get. Have a positive
lessons in canine intelligence. Of course, for a lot of us, if we've ever stopped to think about intelligence in dogs, one of the ways in which we see that play out in an incredible, even spectacular way, is when we see guide dogs at work. And you visited one of the oldest guide dog training organizations in the country and learned a great deal about how this is done. One thing I wanted to ask you to expand on just a little bit, it's a really interesting point. You write, it's the backbone, the hallmark of what these animals do. Explain what intelligent disobedience is and why it is absolutely essential to a guide dog.
Yeah, this was one of those really, really interesting things that I got to learn about and see in action to go forward, and is insisting we need to walk. And the dog knows that there is a car coming because it hears it off in the distance, or that there's a tree branch down or something. The dog has to refuse. And so it's going against the training in a way by saying, no, I'm not doing what you're telling me to do, but it's disobeying for a very good reason. And it's actually protecting the person in doing so. So just, again, something I had never even thought about, but what an impressive mental gymnastics has to happen for the dog to make that choice to refuse, knowing that
Tory and protective urges against us. Just how complicated a matter are we talking about for a dog to be trained to do this kind of work that, in a sense, runs contrary to so much of what would otherwise be there?
To train a dog to do, because it goes against the whole idea of the dog-human relationship to train them to attack. But you know, again, with the right kind of training, a dog is very willing. A dog just needs the right incentive, and they want to do well. These working dogs in particular, they want to succeed. And you can train a dog to know when to bite, but you can also train them to know when to lie down and stop. And I may have said before, they, you know, that's an impressive part of it as well, is just them knowing that they don't get to take that final step. They have to actually stop because that's, you know, what they've learned to do. That's the rule in this case. But it is a hard thing, really, to, you know, and a little bit sad when you think, well, we're training a dog to attack and bite. But on the other hand, what an amazing and powerful service that is for us in certain situations.
Absolutely. I have to say that one of my favorite chapters in your book was chapter 6, which is called Nose Smart. And, of course, for any of us who and it's probably important for anybody who owns a dog to appreciate this important aspect of the way in which a dog experiences the world. And we need to make sure that we allow them that.
Yeah, I do talk a lot about that.
The book is about how we are learning more about dogs and the nature and their intelligence in some really groundbreaking ways.
Yeah, probably the most groundbreaking is that we can train dogs to lie still in an MRI and to do brain scans with them perfectly content and happy, and exposing them to think we're giving dogs a lot more credit for being really interesting and intelligent scientific subjects, and to really dig in and learn more about how they think and learn has been wonderful.
I really especially appreciated the section of the book where you talk about dogs that are trained to tolerate MRI. And you write, if you ever undergone, well, what sounds like heavy metal pans are banged together around your head at random intervals with the volume turned up to 11. It's no fun for a human being, even less fun, one would think, for a dog. And yet some remarkable dogs are actually trained to undergo this and tolerate this. And that has helped us gain a new understanding about how the brain of various dogs work. Let's finish out by maybe giving you a chance to touch on your chapter called Letting Our Dogs Be Dogs, where you give dog owners some very basic yet I think deeply valuable advice on,
again, letting them have the time to do the things that they enjoy. So if that is sniffing, that's certainly one of them. Being more aware of their body language and what they're trying to express. Not necessarily being so ready to
dogs and various breeds.
We bred for, decades to be able to do a certain thing versus your average mutt. You might be surprised to find that the mutt has similar ability and similar intelligence and can really thrive in things that you might not expect. So I think it's very broad, and it really crosses all types of dogs and in all types of situations.
The book, again, is Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence, published by National Geographic. Jennifer S. Holland, thank you for giving the world this wonderful and fascinating book, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
And to finish out, I want to actually read to you a little bit from Chapter 17, Letting Our Dogs Be Dogs, from Jennifer S. Holland's wonderful book, Dog Smart. Kat Warren is serious about her cadaver dogs. Over the years, she has meticulously trained her pups to find the dead, working with them daily, asking them to bring their extraordinary olfactory intelligence to bear when they're needed to help humans solve some of our most heartbreaking problems. But when their services are not required by our species, Warren offers them opportunities to indulge in more dog-driven activities. I really try to give them time when I'm not asking them to do anything, she says. What she calls decompression walks, for example, are long, off-leash outings during which the pups can wander and sniff and play on their own terms, monitored for their safety but otherwise minimally managed, because of their roles as our companions and pets. By making we owe our dogs and how to ensure that they have a good life, not just as our pets, but also as autonomous creatures, has been on my mind of late. Because we ask them to give up a lot of themselves, don't we? To be our very, despite their every natural impulse. We ask hunting dogs to chase and retrieve, but not to kill or eat. Herding dogs just to chase. The war dog must ignore sounds, sights, and smells that could drive any living thing to terror and flight. Assistance dogs must work on command of our working dogs that goes beyond what we'd ask of any child and many adults, often requiring them to shove instincts that have helped them survive for millennia way down inside. Can we be more mindful of all that we ask and all that we take away? Doing better by our dogs does not require upending the dynamics of the human-dog relationship. We will undoubtedly remain in charge, and we will always expect them to adapt to whatever we throw at them. But it's not hard to give the animals back something of themselves, to put more woof into their everyday. I think we owe them that much. We can give them a meaningful life that suits the beings they are, not just the beings they become as our companions. We can give them You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD of British Columbia. A well-known author and renowned expert on dogs, and responsible for a fascinating book called How Dogs Think, What the World Looks Like to Them, and Why They Act the Way They Do. I really have enjoyed this book. Partly, how much can we know about what is going on inside the brain, inside the mind of a dog?
Well, we can know a lot more than people tend to think we know. The very first thing is that we can learn about the dog's system. I'll give you the rule of thumb. The dog has about the language capacity equivalent to about a two-year-old child. So that's about 165 words, signs, signals, that sort of thing. And the super dogs have the language capacity. Best guess is, you know, how would my two-and-a-half-year-old child act in this same situation? Instantly, for a particular action or an object, they will learn that word. That's why so many people, you know, find words that he knows. And he learns these words using a principle which we call a language learning apes.
Talking about. And I guess I'm not even thinking so much about these really exceptional individual dogs, these super dogs, but thinking more generally amongst the breeds. How far a span or wide a span are we talking about?
Well, it is pretty large. I mean, the difference between the top dogs and the bottom dogs is about 8 or 9 months in terms of human development. And given where they are in terms of the scale, that's a lot. You know, your top dogs, your brightest dogs, I'll give you the top brightest, the top seven bright breeds in terms of working and obedience intelligence, at least, and that would be the Border Collie, the Poodle, the German Shepherd, the Golden Retriever, the Doberman Pinscher, the Little Shetland Sheepdog, and the Labrador Retriever. So those are the top seven. They are really quite remarkable, and they can learn a task, you know, many tasks, if they only have, you know, one or two things to learn. They can learn that in, you know, a half an hour, sometimes in as few as 5 or 10 practice tries. The equivalent for what
they speak so frankly.
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference in terms of within each breed. I mean, it's the same sort of thing where, you know, we can say that humans are smarter than cows, but I'm sure that there's some humans where you have your doubts, right? And that's a form of intelligence which we call adaptive intelligence. You see, there really are three separate types of intelligence. The first one is what we call instinctive intelligence, and that's what the dog was bred to do. So, you know, retrievers retrieve and herding dogs herd, and you really can't compare them because they're sort of an apples and oranges kind of a thing. The working and obedience intelligence, which we were just talking about before, is the equivalent of school learning. So it's what dogs will learn under our tutelage and what they'll do for us. And then there's what we call adaptive intelligence, and that's really what the dog can learn for himself. You can think of that as sort of his native smarts. And there's a lot of variability there. And the dogs who are at the top in terms of this, you know, are really dreams to train. I mean, you know, they seem to answer 100% at the time. Whereas the dogs which are in the bottom might respond to the first command only 25 or 35% of the time.
Hmm. You mentioned at some point in the book that just as with humans, when we're talking about dogs, we can find ourselves drawn into this not simple debate of nature versus nurture. And the fact that a dog is born with an array of instincts and with a certain amount of potential, but there is something to be said for the way in which a dog's innate abilities and talents are nurtured.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. You know, suppose that Albert Einstein had been born into, you know, some South American Indian tribe. You know, he never would have produced the theory of relativity because he never would have had the education and you know, the exposure to science and that sort of thing. And we know that there's an awful lot which goes on within a dog, which is determined by the environment. In fact, a number of years ago, the U.S. Army was trying to breed better dogs for the service. And these, you know, included dogs like sentry dogs and tracking dogs. They actually grow faster and so forth. It's also the case that if a dog is going to take instructions from human beings, that dog has to be exposed to human beings. It has to be exposed to human beings for a reasonable amount of time. Wolves are probably the major ancestor. I mean, there's some evidence now that we also domesticated jackals and dingoes and coyotes and certain foxes and some of the wild dogs, and sort of the reason there are so many different shapes dogs running from, you know, a dachshund to a Great Dane is because we have, you know, so many different flavors of genes in them. But the real difference between have flopped ears, which is a sign that they're much younger. The same thing with push faces. All of the wild dogs have very sharp. They're a bit tamer and that sort of thing than the wolves. We've also made them younger. And we've also made them more docile and more baby-like. And maybe that's one of the reasons, you know.
With Dr. Stanley Coren about his book called How Dogs Think. You spend a long time, Dr. Coren, talking about the various senses for dogs. How they hear, how they see, how they taste. How all these various stimuli come into the dog. Why is it important for us to understand the senses of the dog to this extent? How is that helpful to us?
Well, obviously, if a dog can't see a distinction out in the world, then he can't learn it. And it's for human beings, that's a very obvious color. If you see something like that on the grass, I mean, it just sort of leaps out and shouts at us. However, it turns out that that color, that red or that orange, is seen by the dog as the same color that grass is seen. It's just seen as a little bit darker. So you go out and you buy Lassie this bright red toy and you throw it on the ground and she runs right past it and you think she's being either stupid or obstinate. Well, in fact, she's not. She just hasn't seen it. Another thing has to do with the dog's sense of smell. For example, human beings have in their noses the scent-detecting cells or olfactory cells. We have about 5 billion of them. Now, my little beagle has 225 million of those. So, you know, it's a huge difference, their smell, that they're now being used to detect arsons. They can go into a burned building and smell the hydrocarbons, which were used to accelerate the flames. There's also now a whole bunch of scientific studies which show that dogs can detect, for example, they can detect melanoma, which is a really big, bad one. And the two reasons, by simply smelling air that people have breathed into a receptacle, or prostate cancer by smelling urine. So, I mean, that's an awful lot of sensitivity. And it also explains why dogs are so impolite. You know, when Aunt Martha comes in and they stick their nose in her crotch. Well, you know, they're actually seeking information. They're not just, you know, trying to be, you know, nasty or sexual or whatever else. Hmm. It's human beings who respond badly in this case. I mean, there's a wonderful case which occurred up in Danbury, Connecticut, and this on the part of the dog does not constitute sexual harassment on the part of the owner. So,
interesting question. I read with great interest the portion where you talk about a dog's hearing, because it occurs in the mind of the dog, and is it something, an aging process which closely resembles that which occurs in humans?
Well, in fact, it resembles the process in humans so much so that the changes in the aging dog's mind is now being used as the model for the changes which occur in human health. That sometimes that's simply because of the fact that the aging dog, like aging people, will tend to have sort of reduced eyesight and reduced hearing. So it's not so much they can't learn, it's just they can't, you know, perceive what you're doing. But it's one of the most fascinating things which comes out is some information which says it's not that dogs can't learn new things, it's that they have difficulty unlearning old things. So you want a dog to do something different in a situation where they've always done one thing, and that's hard for them. That's really difficult for them. And that suggested to people, well, it's backwards and forwards. The more we know about the dog's mind, the more it suggests about the human mind, and vice versa.
Fascinating. I especially appreciated the moment in the book when you talk about the way in which you've developed a system to communicate with your dog, to say good dog to the dog in a way that you'll still be able to do it long after the day when they're able to actually hear those words.
Oh, yeah. It's really important to have signals for everything which is important. For me, when I say, you know, good dog, when my dog has done something right, I also take my right hand and I just flash the fingers twice. So it's sort of, you know, make a fist and then open the hand twice very quickly. And that means good dog. And right now I have an old dog who's lost about 70% of his hearing. And, you know, I can still communicate with him. And he still knows when he's done the right thing. He looks up and, thank you for having me.
Talking about how they were contending with the difficult challenges of COVID. Elizabeth Stege from Case High School, Polly Amborn from Tremper High School, and Derek Mahan from Wally to them. And you can hear that in the podcast version of The Morning Show tomorrow. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. On Monday, Boyce Upholt, author of a fascinating new book called The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. You'll find The Morning Show archived on our website, wgtd.org. Today's going to be sunny, breezy, pleasant, a high of 76 degrees, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 56. Saturday, clouds rolling in with a 60% chance of some rain. Saturday's high 73, but sunshine returns then, and we should have sunshine all week. In fact, warming into the mid-80s by Thursday. This is WGTDH.